Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Board of Supervisor meeting. The date is April 4th. The time is 9:01. If I could ask everyone to please stand for the Pledge of Allegiance, I'm going to ask Mary Ann Lee, our Health Services Agency Director, to lead us in the pledge and then remain standing. And we have Chaplain Jeffrey Woods from the Barnabas Leadership Foundation who will be leading us in prayer.
Join me in a word of prayer. Heavenly Father, this morning I thank you for the freedom we have to gather and deliberate matters that make a difference in the lives of women, men, and children in our community. Thank you for the men and women you raise up to lead us in making decisions regarding these matters, and for those department heads and staff who will help to carry out the decisions that are made this morning. Thank you, too, for the wisdom and the discernment that you promise to those who seek you. Thank you for those that we honor this month, for the women and men of the public library system who so graciously welcome all who enter through their doors and help connect us with knowledge, with adventure, with meaning. For those from the Assyrian community, and a community that dates far back into biblical times, whom you've settled among us and whom you are using to build up this community. We thank you, too, for those who work tirelessly throughout our community to prevent child abuse, seeking the well-being of the most vulnerable among us, that they, too, might grow up and take their place among us, even helping to lead us forward. Father, there are many details included in the consent calendar this morning that will make a difference in the life and the lives of our community. Though the decision may take only a matter of moments, we do not take them lightly. And we ask that you would guide those who implement them in the next days and weeks and months, even years ahead. Finally, I ask that you would give insight, understanding, wisdom, discernment, and courage to each of our county supervisors as they deliberate. Would you use the gifts, the knowledge, and the experience that you have already given them to help us truly become the best county in America? For I ask these things in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
Thank you, Chaplain Woods. Thank you, Marianne. Okay, we're going to go to item 3, which is the presentation, a resolution proclaiming April 9th, 2017 through April 15th, 2017 as Library Week in Stanislaus County. And the librarian, Diane McDonald, will be presenting. Good morning.
Morning.
They get you nice and low, don't they?
Yes. Okay.
Good morning. Chairman Chiesa, members of the board, CEO Risen, Mr. Doering, members of the public, I'm Diane McDonald, your County Library Director, and with me today is Susan Lilly, Communications, Marketing, and Fund Development Manager. We're here today in celebration of National Library Week and to thank our outstanding and dedicated volunteers. Public libraries have a unique appeal, unlike any other public entity. Our libraries offer a wide spectrum of materials in various formats, and there's truly something for everyone. Next week, April 9th through the 15th, libraries across America will celebrate National Library Week, celebrating the important role libraries play in building a strong and healthy community. National Library Week was first celebrated in 1958 when the National Book Committee, with the American Library Association and the Advertising Council, launched an annual campaign to encourage the use and support of libraries. The American Library Association and libraries nationwide have continued to celebrate and promote libraries. In Stanislaus County, libraries enjoy broad support from all sectors of our community. In 2012, voters overwhelmingly approved a ballot measure to renew the 1/8 cent sales tax that provides almost 90% of our funding for our 13 library locations and for the virtual library, which is available 24/7 online. Last year, 1,783,000 items were borrowed. There were more than 2.3 million visits to our libraries and more than 1 million visits to the library website. Next, I'd like to highlight some of the exciting new and innovative resources the library offers. Today, library customers are using the Stanislaus County Library's mobile app to search the library catalog, place holds on materials, check out ebooks to read on their phones and tablets, download audiobooks, music, movies, and television programs, and learn a new language with Mango Languages. More than 65,000 ebooks, including e-audiobooks, were checked out, representing a 37% increase in use over the previous year. Movies, television programs, and music made up a large percentage of the electronic resources borrowed last year. These categories increased 179% from the previous year. And library customers can even pay overdue fines online from a computer, phone, or tablet. E-resources are unique in that they automatically expire when they're due, so no late fees are ever due on these. So it's something our customers really appreciate. While our libraries are branching out to offer new technology and services, we continue to fill the traditional roles that the community expects. Libraries continue to support early literacy development by targeting readers before their readers through story times, special performances, and learning through play programs such as Lego Days and our 1,000 Books Before Kindergarten program. These programs are designed for infants, toddlers, and preschool-aged children. Through early literacy programs, our children's staff help parents become the best first teachers, educating them about the importance of reading aloud to children and sharing techniques which help develop their children's literacy skills. The library has expanded outreach to children and families, taking library services outside the walls of our buildings. Twice weekly, library staff visit the WIC office in Modesto to host a pop-up library on site. Staff issue library cards, check out books, they read to children, and they discuss with parents how they can help prepare their children for literacy and success in school. Some of the basic techniques shared with parents are talk, read, sing, and play with their babies and children to enhance their early learning. Children's outreach staff also visit local employers to inform their employees about the many services the library offers for their families. And the library is a partner in the Stanislaus Reads effort to improve reading proficiency by third grade, the point at which children are no longer learning to read, but reading to learn. The library's role includes early literacy services both inside the library and out in the community, providing year-round programs and summer enrichment opportunities. Teens are welcome to the library with fun programs and contests to engage this sometimes hard-to-reach age group. Anime Day, Teen Crafts, Game Days, and the Summer Reading Program draw teens into the library, where they also find out about useful information resources for homework and other school projects. Outreach to teens in juvenile detention is also an important component of the library's teen services. Successful teen book clubs have been a welcome opportunity for incarcerated youth to read and discuss books, explore characters, and gain insight on how lessons learned may positively impact their futures. Adults access a variety of both fiction and nonfiction material at libraries countywide. Whether seeking information for a do-it-yourself project, the latest travel book, or just reading for pleasure, the library checks out nearly 1 million items to adults each year. And last year, almost 2,400 adults participated in the summer reading program, sharing their enthusiasm for reading with other adults and modeling good reading habits for their children. Through support from the California State Library and our local library collaborative, $49.99, we are now able to offer Link Plus, a free service which provides our customers access to materials from public and academic libraries throughout California and Nevada. The library continues to be an important source of public computers for those who don't have a computer at home. Customers use public access computers to create resumes, apply for jobs, and to conduct research when starting a new business. For those who have their own devices, the library offers a robust Wi-Fi connection. This service is gaining in popularity, and last year, customers accessed free Wi-Fi at the library 126,492 times. Finally, I'd like to invite you to join me in thanking the many volunteers, Friends of the Library, Library Foundation, and Library Advisory Board for their outstanding support and advocacy for our libraries. As we approach the election on November 7th to renew the library 1/8-cent sales tax measure, their support will be more critical than ever. Our volunteers will be honored, and the Library Foundation will present its Shining Star Awards at a special reception at 2 p.m. Saturday, April 8th at the Nick W. Blum Salida Regional Library. Please join us. That concludes our presentation, and we'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
A quick question, Diane. You talked about the program at the Juvenile Detention Center. Could you just tell me a little bit about that? I wasn't aware of that.
Yes, that's that started, I would say, a few months ago, maybe 6-7 months ago. And it's basically twice a week, our outreach coordinator, Olga Cardenas, and her staff will go out and conduct a book club at the juvenile detention facility. And there's a second facility they go to as well, juvenile detention and juvenile hall. I think it's two separate facilities. And it's been so popular that the young people are really anxious to participate in these programs. And we're looking ahead to actually having a permanent collection out there that can be accessed by the teens, that they can actually check out their own books. So they'll always have reading material there.
Okay. Good. I know as part of our focus on prevention as we move into strengthening families involved in the criminal justice system, we had a meeting the other day, and we call it asset mapping, where we list all the programs that are out there. And I don't know if I saw that in there, so that might be something we need to.
It's fairly new. It's definitely new, and it's evolving. So we'll make sure you get that information.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Come on up, Diane.
Okay.
The takeaway. Hello. Perfect. The takeaway of today is that a traditional library of the 50s isn't today's traditional library. With the e-books, and remember the early literacy, we talk about singing, talking, reading to your children. It is shown over and over and over. Tell your friends. It is so important. If kids aren't reading by the time they leave the third grade, they're in trouble. And we talk about, we don't want to see them. We want to have our juvenile halls empty. We want to have our jails empty. We want to have everything. We want a vibrant community. And some of the services we provide don't make it necessarily a vibrant community, unfortunately. So libraries are important. I want to talk about really quickly doing some exciting things about with Turlock, with Empire. I'm going to make you kind of talk about those two things really quickly before I give you the certificate. And then I'll finish the certificate up.
Okay, well, we have a couple exciting building projects coming up. The Turlock Library has needed an expansion for a number of years, and that's actually finally coming to fruition. We're really excited about this. So we're in the planning stages. And the Empire Library, we are needing a new Empire Library in a better location, and the Empire Hall Community Hall Association, I'll get it right, has actually given us some property, has given the county some property on the other side of Yosemite, so it's next to the school and the park, so it's a great, great location. And we're going to be able to relocate the library there with a new facility. So we have two new facilities coming up, very exciting.
Okay, and so we had a scoping session in Turlock. Pat Portwood, who's a part of the Friends of the Library, she's also on the 8-cent sales tax campaign that will be this November. And so exciting times, and the Empire Library is going to come to fruition through an unfortunate event. They had a fire, and they dedicated the land to the county, which is perfectly located right between our pool facility and the school. So it'll be a great location if we get it done. So with that, the resolution, there's a lot of whereases and therefores, but therefore hereby unanimously proclaim the Board of Supervisors April 9th through the 15th as Stanislaus County Library Week, and urges everyone to visit the local library and take advantage of the wonderful resources available provided through the voter-approved 1/8-cent sales tax dedicated to support our libraries. Remember, 90% of our library is funded through this 1/8-cent sales tax. It's very, very important come November. We're very supportive of that as a board. We appreciate everything you do, and to the volunteers and the friends of the library, thank you so much, because you make it, the volunteers make it what it is. So appreciate everything. On behalf of the board, here's the resolution. I was just reminded that the grand jury, and no one likes to be the subject of a grand jury investigation except for the libraries, who got a accommodation from the grand jury. So it is amazing testament to what's happening over there. Thank you. Okay, now we're going to move on to item four, which is a public comment period. It's an opportunity to speak on anything that is not on today's posted agenda. I have three cards. Please keep your comments to 5 minutes or less. And the first one up is Ms. Betty Brown. Nope, you're going to pass. Okay, so we're going to move on to Terry Snow. Joyce, is it? There's only one way to find out. Okay. Joyce Hickman.
Hello, I am Joyce Hickman, and the reason that I am here is that I wanted to address the Laura's Law that you'll soon be receiving from the county. And I would like to address the reason that the family members are so impassioned to have this law passed. I'm not fond of public speaking, but I am. I feel that this is a very, very important issue. When my ex-husband was 23, he developed paranoid schizophrenia. At 18, my daughter developed panic, anxiety, and agoraphobia that she has suffered with her entire life. Since 18. And then when my son was 20, he spent his 20th birthday in the hospital with his first break, and he has severe paranoid schizophrenia that's fairly treatment resistant. He's living in a board and care home on Floyd now and doing pretty well because he is getting care and getting treatment. My ex-husband is the one that I would like to address. He has been mentally ill severely for many, many years. His mother tried to take care of him by providing a little shed in the back of her property in Willits to keep him from being homeless. The Willits Police Department was very aware of his illness, that he would go out in the middle of the night, yell, disturb the neighborhood because he couldn't sleep. He spent many, many nights not sleeping. My cousins lived there, and the whole town was pretty much terrorized by him. The people at the bank were afraid of him. The people at the grocery store were afraid of him. And he would write letters to my children saying that the people at Save Mart were trying to make him commit suicide because they were covering the meat compartments at night with blankets, and he thought that they were trying to get him from having food, and that way he would starve to death. He was delusional, he was angry, he blamed his mother, he blamed me, but she was there. One night he broke into her house in early morning and was standing over her with a knife. And she talked him out of it, said, let's have breakfast, talk this over, and he backed off. Later he broke into her house, assaulted her severely, and so my point is, trust me, the Mendocino County would have saved a lot of money over a lot of years if they had a law like Laura's Law, or if they had given him mental health treatment rather than allowing him to suffer, because he was suffering greatly too. He has been conserved for a lot of years. They placed him in homes in Sacramento, where he was in locked facilities. He was recently in locked facilities for mental health elderly, and he's now in a nursing home at the age of 74. He used to ride up and down the streets honking at people, waving his fists out the window, hollering obscenities, and this is every time that he would go someplace. But my main point is that this very proud, well-to-do, beautiful woman had to endure surgeries and then spent the rest of her life in isolation because of a disfigured face. And this is the reason that I really hope that when you look at passing Laura's Law or not passing Laura's Law, that you don't just look at the money, but you look at the family's position where we attempt to take care of our mentally ill loved ones, but we're the least effective in doing that. So I appreciate your time, and we have a couple of public forums, and I'm sure you've gotten the information, but it would be very helpful to families if you really looked into what this law might provide for us, even if it's for only a small number of people. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And could I just real quick, yep. Joyce, it was Joyce?
Joyce, yeah.
Joyce, just real quick, I'm sure you've probably attended a couple, we've had two forums already, two kind of stakeholder meetings already, and we've had two stakeholder meetings already with regard to Laura's Law, and we have one more coming, I think, on April 20th, a night.
In the evening.
Right, okay,
and
perfect.
We ourselves will be having another one, NAMI Stanislaus, so that we can have more of our members be informed and more of the public be informed. And I think Paul knows the date of the second one, but I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next up is Paul Golden.
Supervisors.
Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Paul Golden. I'm a good follow-up for Joyce because she's called a family member. And I'm called a consumer. That means I've had a mental illness, and in my case, it's bipolar disorder. Diagnosed when I was in medical school over 40 years ago. I was fortunate because at the time I was in Washington University Medical School, and when this mysterious thing was happening to me that I didn't quite understand, over 3 weeks it became, well, I knew it's a mental problem. And I was able to call the psychiatry department at Washington University. And something the way I said it, that I need an appointment, I got one that very afternoon with, I'll mention his name because he's passed, Dr. James McClure. Long and the short of it is that he saved my life because he knew when I needed to be put in the psych facility at Renard Hospital there. He also knew when medications weren't working, and I had a course of ECT. And again, this is 1973. I responded dramatically to that, and some bumps, actually five further major depressions have occurred in my lifetime, but they were able to be treated with the good medicines that have been developed. But I want to emphasize that if you fast forward to now, particularly in a community where there's no university medical school, and I had developed these same symptoms, I would not have made it. The whole career that I was looking forward to in 73 would not have occurred based on what we have now in mental health field here. Laura's will fill that crack for me. Right now, the only option is about seven private psychiatrists in Modesto and serving Stanislaus County, but they don't go to psych facilities. They are strictly what I call 9-to-5 psychiatrists who mostly see patients with affective disorders. That's bipolar disorder and major depression disorder. Schizophrenics, they're not real happy to take care of. They're energy intensive. And so when they end up at Claus Road, a group of generally locum tenens psychiatrists take care of them. The treatment is poor, and the follow-up is terrible. You know about Laura's Law, and I'm not going to go into that, assisted outpatient treatment. But now, I'm not the seriously mentally ill, and never was, but for the people who are, to have a mechanism where they can get treatment as an outpatient to avoid psychiatric hospitalization and incarceration, mainly. Our jailers and whatnot have become de facto psychiatrists, and that's awful. So I know you are aware of a meeting, it's April 20th, 800 Scenic. It's in the Stanislaus Behavioral Area in the Redwood Room. It's difficult to find, apparently, that room, and it's at 5:30 in the evening to accommodate working people. I'm retired, 34 years practicing nephrology here in Modesto, retired 4 years. And it's so that, we get community input. I mean, there was over 150 people at both events. We'll get a large volume of people in the April 20th meeting, but what we're really hoping is that you as the Board of Supervisors can attend. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Paul, for your comments. I go back to the mental health board that Supervisor Withrow serves on. The reason it's been successful over the years is because both consumers and citizens, as well as an elected official, sit on it. So there's a great transfer of information back and forth. So, okay. All right. Any other public comment? Seeing none, we'll move on to the consent calendar. Is there any board member that would like to pull an item? Anyone in the public like to comment on any item? Seeing none, I'll bring it back to the board for action.
I'll make a motion to approve consent calendar.
There's a motion on the floor. Do I have a second? Hey, buddy. There we go. All right. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries 5-0. On to item B11. Approval to rehire Dr. John Walker for limited purpose prior to the 180-day sit-out period as required by the Public Employees Pension Reform Action of 2013. Mary Ann Lee will be presenting. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm Mary Ann Lee from the Health Services Agency, and I'm before you this morning about a matter of what's critical importance to us, and I'm asking that you consider waiving the 180-day post-retirement sit-out period for Dr. John Walker. And I'd like to explain our circumstances as to why I'm asking for this. We've known of the upcoming retirement for quite some time and had acknowledged it was probably going to be a hard-to-fill kind of a recruitment of this position. And we actually started planning for the recruitment about this time last year. We began working with the chief executive office and planning how we would go about the recruitment. We engaged a recruitment firm that specializes in executive public service type positions. And by fall, we had begun the process of screening and did conduct some interviews. But at this point, we haven't yet secured an ideal candidate for the position. To ensure compliance, Dr. Walker was retiring, and as a matter of state health and safety code, the county needs to have an appointed public health officer because there are particular authorities and responsibilities that go with that position. And you did that. You took an action last week to give the authority to Dr. Del Morris, who's the medical director in the Health Services Agency. Dr. Morris has a full-time job as the medical director of the agency. And we last week you handled a compliance issue to ensure that there was an uninterrupted authority, a person of authority, to protect the community. But we still have a real need, a capacity and expertise need. And so we're asking to be able to have Dr. Walker on a part-time, limited basis to work with us. And I would see that in breaking down in kind of three areas. One would be about public health programming, such as communicable disease surveillance and response, vital records, jail health assurance, our EMS strategic planning. We've got ambulance agreements, that 5-year agreements that come due within a little bit less than a year now. A second area I'm looking at kind of emerging threats. We do need some depth that medical advisory capacity in the case of an emerging health threat. Part of what a public health officer does is to advise OES if we're in that kind of a situation. It also comes with coordination of some resources, mutual aid, some resources in particular circumstances. And then finally, orientation. I mean, we continue. This is an active recruitment. We are hopeful that we're going to be coming before you before too long with a recommendation for an ideal candidate as a permanent public health officer. And we had hoped to have Dr. Walker in a capacity to help with that transition and orientation to ensure continuity and really a proper transition. So with that, I'll stop and see if you have any questions before we consider this.
Are there any questions?
Okay, just real quick, Marion, so tell me where we are in the process, applicants, how close are we? Do we have?
It's active. We are, we continue. We have a qualified candidate that we are in that review process right now. So I really am hopeful that it won't be too long that we'll be making a recommendation. But we're not far enough for me to be able to say something more definitive at this time.
You think like in the next 30 days, or are we?
I'm hopeful in the next 30 to 60 days.
Okay.
If we can do it sooner, we will. But it's a tough recruitment, it's a tough position, and we really need that ideal candidate that's right for our community.
Okay.
Follow up a couple questions. If we have a qualified candidate, and we've already determined he or she's qualified, what is remaining in the process that should take 30 to 60 days?
Because that is a really good question. I'm glad you asked that, because this position is it's not enough to be a licensed physician and to have the technical background and expertise. It really requires someone who is a collaborator, is part of a team that wants to be effective in this role as part of a team. So we're going through a process where it's not just a few individuals that are interviewing. We have engaged kind of a multidisciplinary panel, so we're going through a kind of a multi-stage. The recruiter did the initial pre-screening, and then we, within our public health section of the Health Services Agency, have done an interview. We're engaging a panel, a multidisciplinary panel, before we would then go further with the Chief Executive Office, and to really vet and be sure that whomever we would bring before your board to make that recommendation, we've gone through a really good process.
Which I think is wise, better to hire the right person than to continue to have turnover, I get that. And I'll also recognize patience is not one of my strengths. But why can't that all be done in 1 week? Why can't the multidisciplinary panel be on one day, and if that passes, then it goes on to the executive office, and then I just don't understand. 60 days is a long time. And
I guess I'm a little bit worried about overpromising what the time frame may be, and I know that with candidates, there may be some additional background, there might be more questions, and I've seen this process take some time. So I'm hopeful we beat the 30 days, but I'm afraid to kind of promise that it could be sooner than that.
Okay.
And it is. I mean, this is an important position. It is a two-way street. We want a candidate that is interviewing us too, and is making a commitment to want to work with our community and be our public health officer. So
certainly, I agree. I just would hate to also lose qualified candidates because if we are just dragging out a process, because candidates who apply for jobs are eager to have that come to closure as well with a yes or no.
Right.
So in the time that we've been recruiting for over a year, you said, for this position?
Well, we started the planning process about a year ago and made the determination that we really would be well served, that this might take a pretty wide outreach search. And so then made the decision to work with a recruiter, went through that process to engage. The recruiter actually, we gave a list of stakeholders in the community. So that before the recruiter even started the process, gathered input from the community to find out what's the community want in a public health officer, so that we were really scoping the project well for the recruiter, and then the outreach process began and the pre-screening, and we did have some candidates that went through that process with the panel, and ultimately we didn't determine that that was we didn't find a good fit for an ideal candidate yet.
Okay. So did we learn, and you don't need to get into the lessons learned here, but did we learn lessons about, it just seems that this is a pattern particularly in the health field that we're struggling with. So are we learning lessons about whether we need to start the recruitments earlier or whether we need to pay more or whether we need to do X, Y, Z in order to fill positions when they become available?
In this particular case, because we were hopeful that we'd be successful by now, the recruiter did go back and do some outreach to try to learn from prospective or those that wouldn't, but what would they be looking for? And the two categories of concern were salary and the geographic area. If there's not a reason that someone really wants to be in this area, it's sometimes tough to attract.
Okay, and then my final question is, if this candidate works out and he's hired or she's hired within 30 to 60 days, do we then amend the contract with Dr. Walker? Would we only need him for 90 days for a transition time, or would you still anticipate we would need him for the full 180 days?
I think that we would have Dr. Walker as a part-time employee on a flexible hours kind of a basis, depending on what the need is.
Okay.
When we had originally planned that we would come to you to ask for a period of double fill before Dr. Walker had retired, to ensure that there was time, a really good transition with Dr. Walker. So I think even if we're successful and we're before you soon, we would still want, if that worked, we would still want to have some assistance from Dr. Walker to still assure that smooth transition, and not knowing exactly what the timing is.
Okay. Okay. I agree, in smooth transitions, there's nothing more important than that for long-term success, but there's a time that's appropriate as well, and a time when new people have to be given the reins to take over.
Right.
And 6 months is a long time.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Comments? Any comments from the audience? Okay. Bring it back to the board.
I'll move to approve staff recommendations.
We have a motion from Supervisor DeMartini.
Second it.
And we have a second from Supervisor Monteith. All right. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you.
Thank you.
Tell Dr. Walker, welcome back. Excellent. Okay, on to item 12, B12, approval to accept the annual audited financial reports for the fiscal year ended June 13, 2016.
Good morning. I decided not to be short. Good morning, Chairman Chiesa, Supervisors Mr. Risen and Mr. Doring, Lauren Klein, Auditor Controller, and with me today is Kashmir Gill, the Assistant Auditor Controller. This morning, we will be presenting to you the audited financial statements as of June 30th, 2016. The presentation includes the comprehensive annual financial report, commonly known as the CAFR, and the single audit report, a required compliance audit based on federal expenditures. The audit reports, as well as the audit opinion, provide assurance regarding key financial information of the county. Management decisions and eligibility for various funding rely upon financial information contained in the CAFR. Each year, when we present the financial statements to you, we make a point of acknowledging the hard work performed by all departments. This year is no exception. The completion of both the CAFR and the single audit requires additional effort and partnership with county departments. I would also like to thank Auditor Controller staff, of which many of them are sitting over there. You guys raise your hands. That's your staff who helps prepare these reports. The completion of these two reports requires several months of work additional to our normal daily processes, which is significant for my office. As a board, you should be happy with the results of the audited financial statements. It does not get any better than this. So Cashmo will now provide you a high-level summary of the financial report.
Good morning. We have a brief presentation today to highlight the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report, also known as CAFR, and the Single Audit Report for fiscal year ending June 30, 2016. Both of these reports were audited by the Certified Public Accountants Group of Brown Armstrong. The objective of an audit is to express an opinion that the financial reports are fairly stated in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles, or GAAP for short. Consistent with prior years, the county received an unmodified or a clean opinion on the comprehensive annual financial report. The single audit report is conducted in accordance with OMB requirements. OMB stands for the U.S. Office of Management and Budget, and no issues of noncompliance were noted. For the fiscal year ending June 30th, 2016, there was a reporting change in the single audit report. This slide highlights the change. Specifically, the schedule of expenditures of federal awards, which is a component of the single audit report, now requires the county to report the amount of dollars passed through to subrecipients. A subrecipient is defined as a non-federal entity which receives dollars to carry out a federal program. The subrecipient's responsibilities include client eligibility, performance measurements, program decisions, and compliance with federal regulations. Examples of county's subrecipients include contractors such as Sierra Vista Children and Family Services, Center for Human Services, and Senior Advocacy Network. Of the $186 million of total expenditures reported by the county, $7 million were passed through to subrecipients. Shifting our attention to the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report, a new accounting pronouncement was implemented for the fiscal year ending June 30, 2016. Government Accounting Standards Board, or GASB, Statement 72, establishes standards for measuring fair value of assets and liabilities. Notably, the investments of the county are now required to be categorized based on risk. Valuation techniques have been applied to the investments as prescribed by the new regulation. For more detail of this standard and its application, cash and investments note of the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report highlights the change. At this point, I want to take a few minutes to revisit Statement 68. Statement 68 was effective in the prior fiscal year and resulted in an unparalleled impact on the balance sheet. This statement requires employers to recognize the unfunded portion of the retirement plan. The statement continues to have a significant impact on the county's financial report. As a result of this new standard, the county recorded net pension liability of $202 million in the prior fiscal year. $256 million was recorded for June 30th, 2016. There's an increase of $54 million from the prior year. The fluctuation in the pension liability is due to several factors, such as investment gains and losses of the retirement plan, actuarial assumptions, retirement plan benefits, and retirement contributions. The next slide compares the county's unfunded pension liability to the neighboring counties. The top solid line represents current fiscal year, while the bottom broken line represents prior year numbers. It's interesting to note that in comparison with the prior year, the net pension liability increased for all the counties here. The pattern is consistent, with San Joaquin County maintaining the highest balance of $1.4 billion and Stanislaus County at the low end of $256 million. The pension liability is an actuarial calculation. I'm going to move on to financial highlights for the next two slides. This first slide compares the county's cash and investment balances with prior years. There's a small increase of $2 million from the prior fiscal year. This slide illustrates the net position of the county with prior fiscal years. The net position represents county's net worth, its assets less its liabilities. For fiscal year ending June 30, 2016, the county reported $629 million in net position. This is an increase of $90 million from the prior fiscal year balance of $539 million. The increase can partially be explained to excess general revenues over program deficits. I want to make a note that the last year net position balance of $539 million was low, due to a one-time accounting adjustment. In the prior fiscal year, the implementation of Statement 67, the accounting and financial reporting of pensions, required the county to restate its net position, which contributed to a substantial decrease. In closing, the audit opinions for the comprehensive annual financial report and for the single audit report were clean and consistent with prior years. For fiscal year ending June 30, 2016, the single audit report required the county to report the pass-through dollars to subrecipients. A new accounting pronouncement to measure fair value of adjustments has been incorporated in the financial statements. The net pension liability has been adjusted to reflect the current unfunded portion of the retirement plan. Stanislaus County's pension liability balance continues to be the lowest in comparison to the surrounding counties. The county's cash position increased slightly, while the net position grew compared to the prior fiscal year. With that, we conclude today's presentation. I also want to recognize the department staff, the staff in the Auditor Controller's office, and the Auditor Controller. She forgot to thank herself here. I want to thank the CEO and the board for giving us this opportunity to highlight the results of the June 30th, 2016 financial statements. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. This is important work you do to make sure that we're doing things correctly. I know yesterday I talked with Supervisor Withrow and I said, what do you think about the balance sheet? It's always nice having an accountant on our board. But appreciate all the staff also, everything you've done. This is definitely an improvement, and I love seeing the number not grow by much on our pension liability. So I'm going to turn it over to Supervisor Withrow for his important comments.
Sure. This is our time every year where we get to shine, right, guys? Unfortunately, most of the people left, I don't think they realized that this was coming up on the agenda. Otherwise,
the room
wouldn't have emptied like it did. That was just an oversight, I'm sure, on their part. A little bit more. I want the accounting staff out here. If you guys, instead of just raising your hands, if you could stand up for a second and let's applaud the accounting staff here. You guys all stand up. Get the recognition that we deserve here. Okay. Thank you guys very much. Anyway, great job. You guys, as always, we come out with a great opinion here, a clean report. Just a quick question, if I could. We talked about the year, the June 15, where we took the big hit because of the change. And so that just stayed on the balance sheet, right? And that year, just kind of, we set up that liability, and the offset was to the equity section, I guess. Is that where we basically?
The restatement, the one-time restatement,
right,
was about $203 million.
Right.
Yeah, that will affect your net position on an accumulated basis.
Right. And then for the second year, the adjustment then up, that went actually to our P&L, to our, is that the $54 million for the second year, which
yes,
reflected the increase?
Some of it goes to P&L at the pension expense, but some of it goes to deferred outflows and inflows.
Okay,
yeah.
Perfect. Very good. Okay, anyway, just great job. You know, we can't do anything up here without the work that you guys do. We can't make any decisions that have any value unless we have good numbers that come from you guys. And so we are very proud of what you guys do and the work you do. And anyway, just thank you for all you're doing.
Great. Thanks.
Okay. Any other questions of staff?
I just had some comments there. I was Waiting for Supervisor Withrow's comments there, because he is the accountant there. I know he would sometimes see things that we don't. My comments are only about the Stancera retirement system. We are in better shape than most counties because I think we're better managed. We invest in anything that could make us some money, not politically correct things. The reason why the liability went up this year is we lowered the rate of assumption return from 7.5% to 7.25%. That doesn't sound like much, but it is. When you do the numbers on it, it's millions, probably $30-40 million the difference. And we felt, and our actuary also felt, that the 7.5% assumption on rate of return was a little bit high. And so we lowered it down 0.25%. We probably could have went down 0.5%, but that would have created more of a problem for the county. And even going down 0.25%, we had to phase it in over 3 years, so the hit wasn't so bad. But our system is good. It was very well managed, and we change asset allocation, you know, when we need to. And if our managers aren't doing the job, they're fired. So we have a very good system. I think you should be very happy with Stancera. But that rate of assumption reduction from 7.5 to 7.25 is why the liabilities went up.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the only reason they went up.
It is a relatively small increase compared to the other counties. The jump in the liability of $54 million.
Yeah. And that was about 90% of the increase. You know, things like PEPRA have been worked into the system, and that has reduced our liabilities too, which PEPRA is, defines what is pensionable or not. Say like a uniform allowance, for instance, would not be pensionable. It's an increase in your salary allowance, but it's not calculated as in a retirement benefit. That was a state law, so I mean that is done. And the retirement system did some reforms a few years ago that made quite a bit of difference in our actuarial assumptions on what our liabilities actually are. I just wanted to make those comments. So.
Appreciate it. Any other comments?
Just real quick, I just want to say I got a text from Birgit Flatiger that said the room may be empty, but there's a lot of people watching on TV. So just let you know.
Okay. Anyone in the audience like to comment? Okay, I'll return to the board for action.
I will make a motion that we approve this report.
A motion?
Second.
And a second. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries 5-0. Kind of have a little lackluster vibe going up here today. Can you see that? No. Okay, so now we have to backtrack just a little bit. I have to go back to the consent calendar. We have one little mistake that we're going to correct, and I'm going to turn it over to County Council.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, item C1 was intended to be pulled from the consent calendar. The reason being that after the agenda had been posted, we realized that this particular matter, which was to authorize the Public Works Director to purchase real property, does not require a public hearing to proceed. So it would be appropriate to pull this item and not take any action on item C1 on the agenda. It will continue to be considered on the April 25th agenda, just without a public hearing.
Okay, so we're looking for a motion to pull C1.
So
we have a motion.
Second.
And a second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries 5-0 again. Thank you very much. Sorry about that. Okay, now we'll move on to, we have no scheduled matters, we'll move on to correspondence.
This board has received a worker adjustment and retraining notification letter from NASCO Education, LLC, regarding the permanent layoff of 46 employees at their facility located at 4825 Stoddard Road in Modesto on May 31st, 2017.
Refer to the Alliance WorkNet and the Workforce Development Board.
This board has received a letter from BB Stores, Inc. regarding the planned closure of its store located at the Vintage Fair Mall and the permanent layoff of 10 employees at this location on May 27, 2017.
Refer to the Alliance WorkNet and the Workforce Development Board.
This board has received a letter from the Governor's Office of Emergency Services regarding the U.S. Small Business Administration disaster declaration for primary and contiguous counties, including Stanislaus County, due to the severe storms and flooding that occurred in February of 2017.
Refer to the Office of Emergency Services.
This board has received the claims as noted on the agenda.
Acknowledge receipt of claims and refer to the Chief Executive Office Risk Management Division. Are there any Board of Supervisor reports?
I have one comment, Mr. Chairman.
Sir.
Every year, the Westside Healthcare Task Force does a health summit, and this year we have picked the date of June 29th. In the past, we've done it in August, and we have secured the Newman Westside Theater for the event. And this is our Biggest Loser weight loss contest, where we have teams from the cities of Augustine, Newman, and Patterson compete, along with the school districts and any other private groups that want to compete. And this year, we're doing the event at 5 o'clock in the evening. We've done it at noon in the past. So this is our eighth year at doing this, so we're getting really good at it. So I just wanted to announce that June 29th this year. It's a couple of months early, and it will be in the evening rather than the afternoon. So if you're interested in putting together a team, that would be the time to start putting it together. Teams consist of 10 people. And we the Ag Commissioner weighs them for us. And you know, we have a contest every year. So it's every city has won at least once since we've started. So I just wanted to make that announcement as we're putting together the program now.
Okay.
Oh, and by the way, Dr. Walker is going to be our speaker.
A great speaker. I said, that man practiced what he preached. He used to work out at the SOS Club. Stay in that good of shape.
Yeah.
So that's fantastic. Any other board reports? Okay, we'll move on to Legislative Fiscal and Management Report. CEO Risen.
Yeah, I want to report up at the state capitol last week, the governor, Senate Pro Tem, and Speaker of the Assembly and some other legislative leaders announced a new transportation legislative package. Sponsored in large part by the work done by Senator Bell and Assemblymember Frazier. It's going to be amended into a bill called SB1. It has an annual funding of about $5.2 billion that would be split between state and local investments. It would rely on revenue coming from increased gasoline and diesel excise taxes, diesel sales tax, a new transportation fee based on the value of vehicles, and a fee on zero-emission vehicles. So I know they're trying to see if they can get a vote on that package this week. Secondly, there's a bill, AB 655, that Stanislaus County will be supporting, which would restore renewable energy status to the energy from waste plant that we have out on the west side being run by Cavanna Energy. And that concludes my report.
It's great. The transportation package is in the ICU right now on life support, so we have to do something. Yeah, it's not doing so well. I wanted to recognize Mr. Richard Edgecombe, who's patiently sat out there for the whole meeting, still chairman in charge of. And we just looked at your plaque. We did a tour of the Veterans Center. So thank you for all you do for the community, Richard. Okay. If there's nothing else for the good of the order, this meeting is adjourned.